Your silence is commanding.
Please be seated. Afternoon, we have our third case for today, but before we call it, I would like to, on behalf of the court, have a welcome to the University of Wisconsin Legal Studies class. Would the students join us, please? Thank you. You may be seated. 038, this is a large group. I assume that you are all familiar with the case or have a summary of the case that the court provides in the foyer. If anyone wants a summary and doesn't have it, the marshal, deputy marshal will provide it. Okay, 03-1690-CR State versus Tyrone L. DuBose. Representing the defendant petitioner is Jeffrey E. Olson, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Jeffrey Olson from the Public Defender's Office. I'm here on behalf of Tyrone DuBose to ask this court to change the current rule concerning the admissibility of evidence concerning show-ups, a identification procedure used by the police that has, at least since 1967, been widely condemned as being inherently suggestive.
Counselor, if we agree with you, my question has no relevance, but if in fact we don't agree to change the standard, do you concede that he cannot currently meet the standards to strike the identification that was produced through these two show-ups?
Well, I didn't explicitly address that in my brief in this
court. I know.
I did argue in the Court of Appeals, to no avail, that the show-up in this case was suggestive.
Right.
And I would suggest that the court, even under the current standard, review this very closely for the following reason. There were three show-ups in this case. There was a show-up between my client and the victim, Mr. Hiltzley, within maybe 15, 20 minutes of the offense, and that took place in the police cruiser. After Mr. Hiltzley said, "That's the man," they went to the police station, where Mr. DuBose was put inside a room in the police station and was again shown up one-on-one with Mr. Hiltzley. And then, even though they had already two positive identifications, they took a mugshot of Mr. DuBose and then showed that up singly to Mr. Hiltzley. And I think under those circumstances, this is far more, this case is far more like some of the cases where, some of the few cases, I would add, where show-ups have been found to be impermissibly suggestive.
And also you'd have to say they're not reliable.
I'm sorry?
You'd also have to say it's not only impermissibly suggestive, but it was not reliable.
Right. I'm addressing the first prong. But, for instance, Foster v. California, where they did three, not show-ups, but three lineups. A lineup with some suggestion that the arrestee was the suspect, then a one-on-one show-up, and when that was still tentative, they did another lineup. And the defendant in that case was the only person in both of the lineups. And the Supreme Court found that to be impermissibly suggestive. This court, albeit many years ago, also actually found impermissible suggestiveness in a couple of cases that aren't all that dissimilar to this. The first is State v. Simos, S-I-M-O-S, which is at 83 West 2nd, 251. And there were three photo arrays in that case, and the defendant was the only one in all three of them. And in that situation, they held that that was impermissibly suggestive, although they did go on to find it was reliable. State v. Rozga, which is R-O-Z-G-A, 58 West 2nd, was another one where the court found the procedure to be impermissibly suggestive because after the witness picked the defendant out of a photo array, he was put in a show-up. And then the police suggested to the witness before the show-up that he had indeed confessed to the offense. And they found that all to be suggestive. This is much more like that, where there's a series of suggestive procedures. One show-up by itself, as the Court knows, in the vast volume of cases, is never found impermissibly suggestive. But this wasn't one. This was three. And that should make this a different kind of case. In terms of the reliability test, I have to say that under the way it's currently constructed, I have a very difficult time prevailing. However, I think there are a couple of ways the Court could help me out on that. One is this. The case law is clear from way back that you don't just go through the five factors and then do a reliability assessment. You weigh those factors against the suggestiveness of the procedure. And if that's done explicitly here and the three show-ups are found very suggestive, then I think the reliability test is more difficult, because even though he was confident, for instance, that's one of the factors, that was greatly enhanced by being basically told by the police three times, we think this is the man.
Mm-hmm. What made it impermissibly suggestive? Because we have, as I see it, a choice, as presented by the parties, of three standards. One is the present standard, which you just named impermissibly suggestive, and even if it is, determine reliability, right? That's the present test.
That's the present test.
Federal and state.
Correct.
Okay. We then have your suggested new test, which, if I understand it, is that it's a per se, a show-up, all show-ups are per se suggestive or impermissibly suggestive.
Correct.
And that the state has the burden of proving what?
Proving that it was necessary under the circumstances to do a show-up,
okay,
as opposed to an alternative, less suggestive procedure, such as a photo array or a lineup.
Oh, it's necessity, and we're going to get rid of reliability, since the concept is that's for the jury to decide ultimately whether they trust the
I have one caveat to that.
Okay, what's your caveat?
And that's where I disagree with the amicus.
Well, that's what I was going to get to next.
And my caveat is that in the case of a show-up, if it is found to be necessary under the circumstances, for instance, as the show-up in Stovall v. Deno was found necessary.
That's the hospital room one.
That's the hospital room show-up.
Right.
Before it's admitted, the court should still do a reliability assessment because of the inherent nature of the suggestiveness of show-ups. So that would be my caveat. So their reliability would come into play in the case of a necessary show-up.
Okay. Now, the amicus doesn't agree with you either. What's their position?
The amicus, as I understand it, is agreeing that the show-up should be held to be per se suggestive, and only evidence about a show-up would be admissible only if it was necessary. They don't trust a court to do any sort of reliability assessment before the evidence would go to a jury. They also...
Go ahead. Even if it's suggestive, I'm sorry, the burden would be on the state, I gather, under the amicus, to show necessary.
That's my understanding.
And also to show, as I understand it, that it was conducted in as non-suggestive a manner as possible.
Correct. And I would actually concur with that. That should be done. I would hope that could be done. Under the circumstances, it may be difficult, but that's something that, under my test, a court would assess as part of its reliability assessment. I also disagree with the amicus in this sense. They have a bit broader notion of necessity than I do. I take the position that in my brief that proximity in time and place to the offense is not by itself create a necessity to do a show-up. And the amicus does say that if there is a detention near in time and place to the offense, and the police don't have probable cause to arrest, but only reasonable suspicion, they can do a show-up to, as I think as they put it, to avoid the possibility of a guilty person getting away. I don't agree that a stop for just reasonable suspicion by itself would justify a show-up. I think they should, the police in that situation should try alternative means.
What about this situation, let's say a person is driving down the street and there's some allegation that an offense took place where the person is driving a similar type vehicle and somewhat matches the description. Don't we run the risk, if we accept your position, that someone who's totally innocent, has nothing to do with anything, but who's pulled over on the basis of reasonable suspicion, can be held until you can put together a lineup, until you can put together a show-up, maybe held for a period of, say, a couple hours? What about the inconvenience to that totally innocent party?
If it's just a stop for reasonable suspicion, they aren't necessarily going to detain that long, aren't necessarily going to be able to detain that long. And that is the protection for the person who is just stopped on reasonable suspicion. The police under a Terry stop could take a photograph. They could get more detailed description. They can obviously ID the person. They can do warrant checks and record checks. It's not going to be automatically the case that they can hold the person with reasonable suspicion until they can do a photo lineup or an in-person lineup. So there may be some situations where the police have to let the person go. They've exhausted what they can do under the justification for the Terry stop, and they don't get to do a show-up or lineup with that person at all.
Mr. Olson, following up on that, are you still claiming, as was claimed at the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals, that there was an illegal arrest here?
No, I'm not raising that issue.
Because, as you know, the Court of Appeals said, no, there was probable cause and it was a legal arrest.
Right.
So you're strictly focusing on the show-ups.
Correct. I've not asked this court to review the probable cause determination. That's a well-settled standard of law that's been applied to the facts, and I'm not asking the court to review that. So in this case, for instance, they did have probable cause to arrest. And at that point, the necessity for doing a show-up is really over. They can now lawfully take the defendant to the police station, get a photograph, get other individuals to construct an in-person lineup, what have you, take the steps and the time necessary to do a proper, non-suggestive identification procedure.
Counselor, if you can't do a show-up based on reasonable suspicion, under your theory, and you can't show a necessity to do it based on probable cause to arrest because you're going to have them arrested so you can do it a variety of different ways, you've got more time, when in the world would you never do show-ups then, right? I mean, I don't see when the necessity would ever arise.
Well, again, the necessity would arise if the victim, I think the way I put it in my brief is that if there were, for instance, if the victim was in some sort of, had been injured or appeared to be dying, there was a likelihood that they couldn't do any ID procedure if they didn't do a show-up. Another example might be if the call involved or the crime they were investigating involved someone who had caused serious bodily injury and fled and was believed still to be armed, I think that would be an exigent circumstance to allow the police to do a show-up to make sure they have the right person so that the person who's really out on the rampage is not let loose. But I agree, it's a more restrictive task.
And rarely occur.
I don't think rarely. I think, you know, in many of these cases, the way I see it, there was probable cause to arrest. And I think that's the most probable, most likely situation. And if they have probable cause to arrest, there's no need for a show-up right, you know, at the scene. And there's no need for a show-up at all. There should be incentive for the police to do a proper, non-suggestive lineup that doesn't taint evidence that juries believe is very convincing. And I'm not trying to get rid of show-ups. I know that Mr. Perlman suggests that that would be the effect of this rule, but I don't think it will be.
How would this work in the real world when the police have to figure out what a definition of necessity is? And you painted it two or three scenarios. But in the real world, and if we write this opinion saying that we're going to base this on necessity, how do we define that? Do we outline some scenarios in which necessity would be the case and they can act in that, and then we do this case by case over a number of years?
Yeah, we do this case by case now, and we'll be doing it case by case in the future. The only way we would never do this case by case is if the court said no more show-ups, period. You just can't do it.
But really,
I understand your concern.
Yeah.
That's why I've tried to couch this in existing terms. If you have probable cause to arrest, no show-up. If there are exigent circumstances, a concept that's used already under the Fourth Amendment and determining whether a search was illegal, those are concepts that will have to be developed in the case law, but they're not going to be concepts that are so foreign to police operating now that they will be completely flummoxed by this rule.
Mr. Olson, what is the basis that you would ask us to act on in terms of adopting your suggested rule or the suggested approach of the amicus? Are you talking about due process under the Wisconsin Constitution, or are you talking about the superintending authority of the court? Are you talking about both?
Well, I've asked for both or either or, and the amicus agrees with me on that. I led off by arguing that this in my brief with the due process argument. I acknowledge, as I did in my brief, that this court has been more prone to follow federal case law interpretations of the due process clause. And, you know, one of the things the court looks at is the wording of the constitutional provisions. And, of course, in this case, they're identical. It's due process. There's really no other way to write it. However, that's why I based I gave the court the alternative of the superintending power to ensure fair administration of justice throughout the state. I know again, the court is reluctant to invoke that power, as I said in the brief, but this seems to be an area where the court should be very interested in invoking its superintending power because of the consequences of wrongful identification or mistaken identification leading to wrongful convictions and the impact that has on not only the court system but the entire criminal justice system.
Do you see one approach as being preferable to the other?
I think that due process is preferable to me because of its constitutional dimension. And because that is the sort of the wellspring of all this, all the rules we have today, with Stovall v. Deno acknowledging and recognizing the due process interest in a defendant having a non-suggestive identification procedure and avoiding being convicted on unreliable evidence.
Yeah. Well, 9 years ago in Wolverton, which is the case that you cited, which is 1995, you're asking us basically to undo or throw out, overturn Wolverton, obviously.
And you have to go further back than that, I guess.
You have to go 50, 60, 50,
right. Well, into the late 60s and early 70s. Isham, Strike, Jones, DiMaggio, there are a number of cases.
Because this court is usually, well, let me say almost always, followed the U.S. Supreme Court precedent, particularly when the wording is the same in this case.
Right. I acknowledge that. I do. But I think this is one area where the courts should be concerned about the what I think is the clear deficiencies under the current rule, which is the federal rule. And this court shouldn't be hesitant to depart from a federal rule that, in its view, isn't working or is not providing justice and not providing due process.
But then we'd be in the position of one case saying, well, the words are exactly the same, and so we interpret them the same. And then when there's another issue under due process, and we certainly have a lot under that umbrella, we say, well, now they don't mean the same thing. They mean something different. That makes us a little scattered in our interpretation, don't you think?
It's hard when you have such a broad statement as due process, because that encompasses so much. And I acknowledge that, and that's why I gave the court the alternative, or suggested the alternative, of the superintending authority.
But if we do it under the superintending powers, then it's not a basis for a collateral attack, right? So you have to have a constitutional violation.
You would need a constitutional violation. That's correct.
Seems to me that the basis for your coming in and asking that we divert from prior rules about show up is that the social science studies and evidence that would indicate our prior cases may be based on faulty premises or logic or understanding. Right?
Correct.
All right. And at least in my limited reading in this area, seems to me most of the writing is on lineups and photo arrays, not on show-up. And that probably, I don't know whether, my assumption is that there are more lineups than there are show-ups, and maybe that's why the emphasis is on lineup, but I don't know if that's true or not. And it's also seems to me from my reading that contrary to what we've all been taught, or think we've been taught, that you bring in the lineup and show everybody, a whole slew of people, that maybe single photos at one time are better than multiple photos, etc. So after I did all that reading, I thought, gee, show up sounds like this single array of photo, single photo. And I find very little, and I can't say I've read everything, on show-ups contrary to lineups. And so tell me what your social science evidence is on show-ups in contrast to lineups. Let's not talk about lineups. This is not a lineup case.
It's not a lineup case. You're right. I did address this in my brief.
I know, but I'm still not persuaded.
There are studies dealing specifically with show-ups that do show that they're less. They result in fewer
positives.
There's a greater
fault,
inflated chance, and I think the reasons for those are several. Let me rephrase that. The problems with show-ups are several, and you can discern them by comparing a well-constructed lineup to the show-up. One thing that the research has shown is that the completely unintentional and inadvertent conduct by the persons running the show-up can signal to the witness who they think the suspect is or who they should pick.
And here the witness was told this could be the man.
Well, and the show-up inherently does that.
Right. Okay.
So that's one aspect. The purpose of a lineup frequently is to, in fact, in a lot of lineups, they develop the lineup based on the witness's identification. And a well-run lineup is supposed to comport with the witness's identification. And in a show-up, you don't necessarily have that. You have the person who was nabbed the quickest. And there will be some similarities, but it may not be similar at all. And therefore, you're not trying to, again, comport the photo array or the
to make
or
this
display with
make
the witnesses.
This show up less suggestive, should they have spent more time with the witness getting a better ID?
That is one thing that the research suggests, that there's got to be a more thorough and careful interview with the witness to get as much detail as possible. And that may or may not happen in a show-up. Obviously, if there's show-ups are broadly allowed to be used and admitted, there's not much incentive for the police to do that before they do the show-up. If the whole purpose of the show-up is to do things as quickly as possible, then it's going to cut into the rationale or the reason for engaging in a more thorough investigation of what the witness has to say. The other thing is the whole sequential lineup and comparing to the other people in the lineup rationale just obviously doesn't apply to show-ups because there's no one to compare to. And while there's some suggestion that that's good, that the sequential lineup is meant to show the person one face at a time so that they don't do the relative judgment between the people in the lineup, the show-up, that doesn't really apply because, or that avoidance of relative judgment doesn't apply because there's only one face to look at. So, and the last thing is that the well-run lineup tells the should tell the witness that the person may or may not be in. Now, that's something that can be done in a show-up, and that's something that the amicus suggests. It's something that, as the Court may know, the Avery Commission recommendations address that. The U.S. DOJ recommendations also suggest that. So that is something that could be done in a show-up. But for the most part, the very way that a show-up is conducted puts it completely at odds with a well-run lineup. And I see my red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. David H. Perlman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Perlman.
Justices of the Supreme Court, good afternoon. The state seeks from this court an affirmance in an opinion holding, first, the state will follow its own precedent and maintain the two-pronged test for determining the admissibility of pretrial identification evidence. And secondly, that the court, after applying the test to the facts and circumstances of this case, decides that the show-up evidence was properly admitted. But I suspect that's not the reason that I should be here today in front of you. You understand what I want, but I should be able to explain to you why the state feel it deserves such an opinion. The state.
But before you do that, it's my understanding both from, and I don't know if you were there for a seminar that we held on criminal justice and the concepts of DNA and eyewitness identification, et cetera, that the, and it's my understanding that the AG's office, your office, has put out standards for eyewitness identification. Is that right?
Chief Justice, that's mostly correct. Okay. From what I understand, the Department of...
For education for law enforcement.
The Department of Justice is still in the drafting phase, Your Honor.
Is it in the drafting? Is it at a public record?
It's not yet finished, as I understand it, but it's in the drafting stages.
But has it been distributed for circulation?
It has not, to my knowledge, been distributed to law enforcement. I was not involved in the drafting or the critiquing of it, but it is policies and procedures for police officers to follow for all identification.
Does it cover show-up?
Yes, it does. A very small section of it is allowed to show-ups, most of it focusing on lineups.
What does it say about show-up?
Again, I have not reviewed it comprehensively, but what I recollect, it likes show-ups, again, emphasizing necessity, and in that sense, it draws a line between arrest and detention. However, it also discusses a preference towards geographic and temporal proximity. It favors that the subject be transported to the defendant as opposed to the other way around. It prefers show-ups not to occur in a police station. And it prefers that the police, in introducing the subject, the victim to the subject, says benign language such this might be the suspect, this might not be the suspect.
What about a police car?
It indicates a disfavor for the car, but also has kind of a caveat, as I recollect, that facts and circumstances and safety considerations could dictate that.
Would this be a subject for judicial notice of the court?
Well, again, I was not prepared to really discuss these rules, and I'm not comfortable because they're still being drafted, but obviously if these rules reach final form and are produced, I would be comfortable with the court examining them.
But not this moment.
Is it your department's intent when the rules are drafted to comport with our case law as it currently stands, or is this something that you see that goes beyond perhaps what might be found in the cases?
Your Honor, I believe that the rules in no way suggest the changing of the legal standards in terms of what we're talking about today. The rules do not call for an abolishment of the Wolverton standard. It really is a series of procedures recommended for the police to implement. And I would submit that that would be a proper way anyway to address a real problem of misidentification as opposed to this Court reversing its own well-established precedent and doing what no other court in the country has done.
Go ahead, counsel.
No, excuse me.
I was going to say that it seems that your opposing counsel bases most of his argument on the, quote, scientific readings that and research that has gone on. I assume you have read that, at least some of the things that have come down in the last couple of years. In what way would that change how this court should operate as far as this decision?
I don't think it should change this decision, Your Honor, for the following reasons. The literature, and I've read, of course, opposing counsel's brief and the amicus brief, and I read some of the articles that were cited, talk about some of the problems inherent in identification. As the Chief Justice noted, most of the literature seems to be addressed on show-ups as opposed, lineups as opposed to show-up identifications. But what we are offered by DuBose are rules that I think actually do nothing to further the due process interest and, quite frankly, are completely impractical. As Justice Rogensack mentioned, if a person is in probable cause and you cannot do a show-up, or a person in the Justice Butler hypothetical is in a Terry stop and you can't do a show-up, when can you do one? And that was my major theme of the brief. We are left with a stovall near that situation. That, in effect, is a de facto abolishment of the show-up procedure in my mind. The counsel...
Let me interrupt you at this point because I want to go back to something you said a couple minutes ago. You said no other state has done anything like this.
Yes.
Now, when I read the briefs, it seemed to me that what had been done in Massachusetts,
yes,
what had been done in the state of New York, was certainly very similar to what's being proposed by defense counsel and by the amicus. Tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, you're correct, Your Honor, in what you state. But the conclusion, I think, is wrong because what the brief failed to show is that both in New York and in Massachusetts, they were not reversing their own precedent. Neither Supreme Court had a precedent such as this Court does with Wolverton. As a matter of fact, the Massachusetts Court specifically said, we have held open our evaluation of the Manson test and waited for this moment. I might add as well that the facts that spawned those three courts' decisions were far more egregious than the facts here. They involved show-ups 18 to 20 hours later. In one case, they involved a man handcuffed to a fence with five officers present and a shining light in his face saying, there's your guy. And they even called that a close call. What I'm saying is this court is being asked the unprecedented step of reversing its own precedent. And additionally, the problem that I'm having with this constitutional argument, I wouldn't say it's this court's own precedent, but this court in the past has indicated when a Wisconsin Constitution argument is raised, they like to see some history about the provision. They like to see some recitations of the case law relevant to the provision. And DuBose offers nothing in that regard in his brief or in his argument today. He's basically suggesting to this court that it change its interpretation of the Constitution because it can, but gives no...
As I understand the defense and the amicus argument, I think what's being suggested is that the court look at its precedent from the standpoint that the precedent as a practical matter just simply doesn't relate factually to what really takes place. In other words, the whole purpose of the prior precedent is to engage in reaching a reliable result with respect to eyewitness identifications.
Yes.
Yet the bottom line is what we're getting is not reliability. So where should we go in order to try to either come up with some reliable approach at identification or in the alternative, as the defense suggests, shift gears and look more at the process issue?
Well, I think that, and I understand, if I understand your point correctly, what you're stating is that's fine about precedent, but we have this problem, this identification, which could be a tangible evidence that the precedent is unsuccessful. So that could be a basis for change. And without getting into the fact that that would create other issues that Justice Rogensack talked about your interpreting due process clauses similarly, but getting to the actual merits of it, I submit that the rules proposed by DuBose and Amicus are worse than your current standard. I propose that they more aptly will exclude reliable identifications. For instance, take the example that you yourself gave of a Terry stop situation. A man has just been stopped. The threat is of a crime. They don't have enough probable cause to arrest. You know the victim is three blocks away. That is a classical example of where a show-up could have great utility. It could stop a man from being wrongfully detained for several hours, and in that wrongful detention for several hours to set up the show-up the way that DuBose would want it, another man could be walking around, running around. And he even talked about the evil of another guy lurking around as possibly necessary. Well, in this case, we had an armed robber.
Mr. Perlman, doesn't that situation you've just described fit very much with the Amicus's approach of necessity or of exigent circumstances? Isn't that what you're describing?
No. Well, if I was describing it, I didn't intend to quite limit it that way. I very much don't like the dividing line to be detention versus arrest. I think that's an unrealistic line. To give you an example, let's look at the facts of this particular case. An arrest was made, but probable cause does not stop investigative inquiry. I would submit the arrest was made through diligent and very efficient police work, setting up a perimeter, using a canine tracking unit, and apprehending the suspect within minutes of being notified of the event. Yet they have the victim just three blocks away. Should they be prevented the opportunity to find out if they're correct in their probable cause assessment?
Here's what the amicus is standpoint is, and this was like 1:30 in the morning, right? It's not in the afternoon.
2 a.m., I think, Your Honor.
2 a.m. This is a page 9 of the amicus. Here's what they say is the following test, which differs from, as I read the defendant. Show-up identification evidence is inadmissible unless officers lack probable cause to make an arrest. So it means you don't want to detain the guy if you can't really arrest him. And that's what's explained in the paragraphs before. Unless officers lack probable cause to make an arrest and for that reason or because of other exigent circumstances, which I would say is 2 in the morning, they could not have conducted a lineup or photo array. What's the matter with that?
Well, the problem that I have, again, is that, first of all, I'm uncomfortable with necessity being the linchpin of this whole analysis because I think necessity is very difficult to define. And
Is necessity harder or easier than reliability?
I don't think it's any easier or any harder, but reliability, at least now we have 5 specified factors for the court to address. And necessity can call for different conclusions. I would argue, Your Honor, even though I would be uncomfortable if the court went in that direction, that this particular show-up would even survive DuBose's rules or the amicus rules.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say to you. So the show-up identification is inadmissible unless they lacked probable cause. Here they had probable cause?
They had probable cause to arrest.
Without the identification?
Without the identification.
All right. So you don't fall under that.
Right.
But you still have exigent circumstances. And if you believe the theory that the victim's memory will fade over time, you might want to do that so they couldn't conduct a lineup or photo array.
Right.
But then you go into whether or not this was impermissibly suggestive.
Right. They are arguing that this Court not go into that inquiry because they're saying it's unnecessary. I'm saying that while I don't think necessity is the test, I think it's impermissible suggestiveness, even for the sake of argument, if we were to adopt DuBose's or the amicus position that necessity is the linchpin, there was necessity here. It's 2 a.m. in the morning. We're in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We've had an armed robbery. We have just caught a man. If he's not the right man, somebody else with a gun is running around the streets.
You're going to take him into the police station. Can't you do a photo array there within a half hour to an hour?
I can't say exactly how long that would take, Your Honor, but I think that in a crime this fluid and this volatile, every minute is important, and they had the opportunity right now to do this, the defendant and the victim. The defendant was caught quickly. The police were very fortunate to make such a quick apprehension through their diligent efforts. Should they be denied the opportunity now to do a show-up in its most classical form?
As I understand it, here's the problem, though, and if you look at the data that's been provided for you, read both the amicus and the defense brief, the issue becomes that when you're getting somebody at 2 in the morning and the police have a person sitting in the back of a squad car and you bring a citizen who's given a brief description to the police, now they're looking at somebody who looks kind of close to what they've described and they're already sitting in the squad. I think the data that's been suggested, and the data that was, I believe, produced at the Avery Commission and that we saw at the conference, suggests that something cognitive takes over where you then start making the leap that this is, in fact, the person. So, in effect, what you could have is a situation where the person locks into the identification, yet the very concern that you've mentioned about the bad guy running around on the street with the gun, he may still be out on the street with the gun. That's the problem.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think, and I would in any way dispute the fact that there's something suggestive about show-ups. This Court has consistently held so. The issue, I believe, is impermissible suggestiveness. And when I look at the situation here at 2 a.m., I thought they made it as benign as they could. He was alone in the squad car. He wasn't accompanied by several officers. While they didn't exactly say completely neutral words as this might or might not be your suspect, they did not say we caught the man. They said this might possibly be the person you're looking for. He was driven up to him as opposed to being in police custody driven there. I think under those circumstances that's not impermissibly suggestive. And I would argue even if we thought it was, there were a lot of factors in this case that support its reliability.
In the Anika's brief on page 10, and I circle this, in Du Bois' case, the police unnecessarily introduced suggestiveness in an already suggestive show-up by displaying him first confined to a squad car. I talked about, with your opposing counsel, the practicality of all this. Where do you think they should show this person? First of all, if it is a dangerous person, it's reasonable to confine the person in some way.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to think where they don't suggest where this ought to be, but apparently in a police car it is suggestively tainted.
Well, of course, the police car was the exact facts in Wilmington, as this Court knows.
Right.
But beyond that, you have somebody who's just been arrested for a serious offense. I think it's very imprudent to have the victim and the witness on top of each other in such a circumstance. So I think they set it up as best they can. One in one squad, one's in the other. It's not in the police station. The record, I believe, is silent as to whether or not he could observe that DuBose was handcuffed in the squad car. And I think under the circumstances that they had, they set it up in as benign a way as they could and still maintained the safety consideration.
But you had three show-ups in a short period of time where the same individual is shown all three times. Isn't that suggestive?
Well, in his brief, DuBose argued mostly about the first show-up, arguing that the first show-up was contaminated and the others were not. My position is that the first show-up was permissible and hence the second and third show-ups were not contaminated. If you're asking me in a perfect world, do I felt there was a need for those second and third show-ups, I would say no. I'd say the first show-up was essential. was well done and fits within our standards. And I could argue, as the Chief Justice and I were exploring, fits even within, arguably within Dubose's new rules, which I asked this Court to reject, or the amicus rules, which I asked this Court.
Except that there was probable cause to arrest, so it doesn't quite fit.
Right, but they say the exigent circumstance exception is what I would use. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's an easy fit, and I certainly would be concerned if that's the avenue the Court went to adopt their rules.
Counsel, much of the response that you've been giving to questions asked by counsel deals with exigent circumstances. Here it is, 2 a.m., Green Bay.
Yes.
What's wrong with saying, okay, maybe in this situation you're focusing on the first show-up, our exigent circumstances, but under our administrative superintending powers, adopt the proffered rule of the amicus? What's wrong with that for the administration of justice? Because we all know there's problems with show-ups being and the suggestibility that attends to show-ups.
I mean,
you recognize that too, you know. So it's
yes, I think I do, and I recognize so in my brief. Although I argue that the current test is the best, is better than the two offered alternatives, and that the problems are not inherent in this particular show-up. As far as the question of superintendent, Your Honor, I'd have two problems. This Court, of course, is far more familiar with me with its own powers. But I would think that this Court would be circumspect about using its superintendent powers to impose on courts rules of exclusion in the absence of a constitutional violation. Or alternatively, I think that
Counsel, let me say that it is going the superintending route in order to, if you will, not having to embrace the constitutional issue with its attendant problems and ramifications.
I also would be concerned, Your Honor, that the superintendent powers here would be more addressed, it would seem, for police practices than the courts.
Well, we are dealing with what's the police can do anything they want. I mean, I shouldn't say anything they want, but the police can do a lot that's out of our controls, and far be it from us to try to control. But we can control what is admissible in courts in this state, and that's what I'm talking about. It's admissible into evidence in courts of the state. That's something we can control.
But again, you would be imposing your rules on courts to exclude evidence, which is consistent with the Wisconsin Constitution and the United States Constitution. There'd be no constitutional violation, and you'd be imposing an exclusionary rule.
So you're suggesting that before we employ our superintending authorities, that it should always have with it a finding of constitutional impediment that would authorize us to do that? It seems kind of inconsistent that we need constitutional deprivation in order to assert our superintending authority.
Well, this Court has consistently held that it exercises this power very sparingly and judiciously.
Correct.
And those are my two focal points of concern is that there's no constitutional violation, and it would seem that still, whether it's, the end result is admissibility of evidence, it would be pointing a finger, or not a finger, but it would be making strong suggestions of proper police practices. Because that's apparently what is at issue, at least from the other side, that they don't like the police practices that were used here. I just want to address again the necessity issue. That's the linchpin of their argument. I'm very uncomfortable with it. The only legal basis for it, as I can ascertain, is the Stovall case. I am bemused at how the amicus and how Dubose loves the Stovall case, arguing that that case was when the Court got it right, when they were looking at the propriety of the procedure. I respectfully submit the procedures employed in Stovall were pretty rough. Five police officers walked him in, handcuffed, and two district attorneys. It was like a legal conference in the hospital room. There was no need for that much action. And they didn't say, as was here, we might have the suspect. They said, is this your man? and they even had him talk, and she's near death in the hospital room and makes an identification, and they say fine, and that is the basis for the necessity doctrine. I find it a bad poster child for fair practices. What I really think Stovall was mostly about, frankly, was that at that time it was decided the same day as Wade. They were wrestling with a different issue, and that is, since it was a post-indictment, pre-trial identification, whether or not there would be a right to counsel there, and they found that Wade there should be, but they refused to apply that law retroactively. That was the major focus of Stovall. And to prove that, within 1 year, the court made clear that it was looking at the more complete picture. They were looking in the case of Simmons, in which they let the evidence in, although they were a little uncomfortable with the procedure. They talked about reliability factors. It had not yet matured enough to attest, but they talked about it. Foster, where there was an exclusion, again had a lot of emphasis on reliability because three times the victim, wavered in his identification, a factor we do not have here. And then I believe the doctrine continued to evolve. So I reject the amicus and Dubose's position that the court got it right and retreated. I rather submit that Stovall was an awkward first step and the doctrine evolved.
Mr. Perlman, when I read Stovall, it struck me that the court was emphasizing not only necessity, but was also looking at the fact that this show-up procedure was occurring in the absence of counsel. So while I understand what you're saying about Wade, it seems to me that the court certainly was troubled by this procedure in the absence of counsel and was very clearly thinking at the same time about the right to counsel. Do you disagree with that?
No, I agree with you completely, Your Honor. I think that was the emphasis of the opinion, but they decided to not apply the Wade rule retroactively. That was the major issue because, very much unlike this case, that was a post-indictment identification. Here it was just after the arrest. And the other thing about Stovall is what they really liked at the end. They said, here is the one person who could say that is the man or that is not the man. So it apparently had a lot of confidence in her ability to do that. The record of the case is silent as to what factors led them to believe that she could make such a categorization, but I think reliability, if not discussed, is sort of almost inherent in that, and that's why the doctrine continued to develop along the cases reaching its maturation in the Manson two-prong test.
Mr. Perlman, if I could, I'd like to ask you a question, and I recognize it may be a bit unfair, and if it is, please tell me so. But I've heard you argue that you reject the test that has been offered by the defense and by the amicus. You defended the test that we currently have, but I think you recognize, and you recognize in your brief and your argument, that there is a problem with respect to eyewitness identifications. And I understand that the focus of Wolverton was to look towards reliability, yet we seem to have a problem with reliability. To the extent that you may have thought about it, do you have an alternative that would help bring about more reliable identifications other than the ones that have been suggested by the defense or the amicus or the one that currently exists?
Well, Your Honor, first off, that question is not unfair. It makes me uncomfortable. That in no way compromises the defense. Yes. Frankly, I have not thought about it that much. I think that the best solution to this issue is to maintain the current test, but to perhaps have more improvement in police policies and procedures. And where those improvements and policies and procedures widely distributed and known by counsel in courts, it could be that in analyzing these tests, they'll have a more discerning eye as to whether or not the procedure used was impermissibly suggestive or alternatively was reliable. So I think there's nothing wrong with the current test, and as science continues to get more and more sophisticated, then the application of the test will be more and more sophisticated.
You discuss the right to counsel in relation to the test proposed by the amicus.
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think I understand the question.
Well, as I understand it, the amicus would be interested in more lineups. But isn't there a right to counsel at a lineup?
Yes, Your Honor, respectfully, I'm not really prepared to discuss lineups or the procedures for it. I focused my entire attention on show-ups. I apologize.
In conclusion, would you summarize why the show up here was reliable?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. It was reliable, first of all, because the victim spent a fair amount of time with the defendant. He spent time with him in the parking lot. He spent time with him in the car. He spent time with him in his house. And I think it's also important to note that most of it, for lack of a better term, is non-victimization time. In other words, he thought he had a friend. So I noticed that some of the research indicated that when you're victimized and you're in terror, your perceptions aren't so good. Most of the time when he was with him, he wasn't in that condition because of the fact that it was just a friendly encounter, and only at the very end did the situation change.
He was buzzed, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
would you define that for us?
You did focus on the one fly in my reliability ointment, but I'm not here to prepare to study the effect of buzzdom on your perceptions. I would say also that the room was well lit where he was at his home, that he even knew this person as a sometime, didn't know him by name, but as a sometimes customer at the liquor store that where he worked. And that, you know, he also quickly gave an identification. There was no equivocation here. He put a percentage figure on it. You know, I guess he liked numbers. He said 98%, but it was unequivocal. So he had a clear, confident, he was paying attention to this man, first of all in the friendship context, and secondly, as he put in an artful way, that you tend to pay attention with a person who has a gun pressed to your temple. So he did pay attention to him. So I think in almost all the factors were present for reliability. A substantial period of time with him, some of it non-victimization time. He knew him from the past. It was a well-lit room. He was made a confident, clear, unequivocal identification.
Mr. Perlman, I've got a question about how the testimony came out at trial. I know, at least I understand, that the victim identified the defendant at trial.
Yes.
Was there a lot presented to the jury about prior identifications? Was there anything presented to the jury about prior identifications?
I apologize, Your Honor, I do not know. I do not know. I know that he did testify both to the pretrial identifications, and he also identified him at trial.
All right. And at trial, he testified to the fact he'd identified him previously.
Yes, sir.
That is on the record.
Yes, sir. In conclusion, Your Honors, we have a man apprehended by the police after being tracked by a K-9 unit hiding in the immediate vicinity of the crime. The subsequent identification occurred within blocks and minutes of where the crime took place, and the show-up identification was made by a victim who had spent time with DuBose at the parking lot, in his car, and in his home. And who had seen DuBose in the past at the liquor store where he worked. His clear, unequivocal identification of DuBose resulted from a permissible procedure and was also reliable. The State respectfully fails to see how the exclusion of this identification evidence promotes justice or how the admission of this evidence violates the due process right at stake. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, I see that the conclusion of your brief is that because the show-ups were not necessary, the show-up evidence should have been suppressed, and he is entitled to a new trial at which the evidence may not be introduced. If we're going to put up a new standard, as you say, why shouldn't it go back to the trial court to make a determination if the new standard was met or not met?
Yeah, I think that excuse me, would be the appropriate mandate, is that if that's the new standard, then the remand would be, or in remitter, the directions would be that because a show-up is per se suggestive, the State would then should be given the opportunity under the new rule to prove that it was necessary, that there were exigent circumstances, and if a trial court would determine that it wasn't necessary and suppress the evidence of the show-ups, there's still a question about the in-court evidence. Under the current standard, which we are not addressing in this case, it just never came up, is that even if a pretrial identification procedure is suppressed, the State has the opportunity to prove that they should be allowed to have the defendant identified in court because there's an independent source for the identification that's reliable. And, for instance, this court, right off the top of my head, dealt with that in State versus McMorris, which I think is 213 with second. The pretrial identification was suppressed not because of suggestive show-up, but because of a pretrial lineup that was conducted without benefit of counsel. And that gets to Justice Prosser's question. In terms of the preference for show-ups under the proposed rule of either Mr. DuBose or the amicus, the right to counsel at a lineup, it's not absolute. It only attaches after there's been formal initiation of a prosecution. So if there's a pre-charging lineup, my understanding is that there would be no right to counsel. In this case, for instance, Mr. DuBose was under arrest. If they had, instead of doing a show-up, taken him back to the police station and within an hour conducted a live lineup, Mr. DuBose would not have had the right to counsel at that lineup.
Wouldn't defense counsel be arguing in the future that there's no reason why, when someone is in custody that way, that they shouldn't have counsel present? I mean, well, certainly Miranda warnings would have been given at that point, would they not?
I guess potentially someone could argue that. The longstanding precedent, going back to the cases in the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court following Wade, are clear that right to counsel, because it's a Sixth Amendment right, only attaches once prosecution is commenced. So I don't see that. I would suspect that wouldn't be much of an issue.
You're relying on due process now, aren't you?
Yeah, this is due process. This is pre-charging. This is due process. It's not a Sixth Amendment right to counsel issue.
Well, how do we know what's exactly happening at this lineup if we don't have counsel present?
Well, my experience with lineups in cases is that it's well documented. I mean, that's part of the ordinary police procedure, is to document if it's photos, which photos were used, or if not photos, then they have, obviously, they keep a record of the individuals who were used in the lineup and what they looked like. And so it's like any other police procedure. There are going to be notes and there will be police reports about how it was conducted. So I want to address a couple of points that came up during Mr. Perlman's discussion. First, he mentioned in response to a question from Justice Crooks that the states of, for instance, Massachusetts and New York the rule that they've adopted that's similar to ours. We tried to distinguish those cases on the ground that they were not reversing their longstanding precedent, as this court would have to do. And I would submit to this court that doesn't change the rationale for the rule that they adopted in those cases, which was the due process interests of the defendant. The reliance of the amicus and Mr. DuBose on Stovall, I just want to address that for a moment. I'm personally not that fond of the facts as they were, as they came down in Stovall. And there's been some criticism of whether that was really an appropriate and necessary procedure in some of the academic literature, which we don't need to go into. What the importance of Stovall for us is that is the case where the Supreme Court adopted and recognized the defendant's due process interest in not having unnecessarily suggestive procedures being used to create eyewitness evidence. And that's really the importance of Stovall, unless the particular facts of the case. And I see again my red light is on, and unless there are further questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, and thank you, Mr. Perlman, for discussing show-ups with us today in light of current thinking in the social science studies. And that concludes our hearing in 03-1690-CR, and the court will meet in conference at 3:10. And if I could see both counsel for a moment. Please stay. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 for oral argument.